This is Future Fork, a show that explores the world of food and the decisions we can make today that will shape our future. On the show, you'll hear from innovators in the food space. We'll have disruptive conversations with people from around the globe who are taking the lead on topics like food sustainability, ending world hunger, food security, and so much more. I'm your host, Paul Newnham. In today's episode, I'm joined by Michael Sheldrick. Michael is the author of From Ideas to Impact, a playbook for influencing and implementing change in a divided world. And he's the co-founder of Global Citizen, an action platform dedicated to achieving the end of extreme poverty. In today's conversation, you'll hear how Michael is working at Global Citizen to achieve its mission through policy advocacy and accountability. We'll talk about how fatherhood has impacted Michael's work, and Michael shares some of the lessons he learned in writing his new book and how it helped him turn them from ideas into impact. Let's dive in. Michael, welcome to the show.
Great to see you, Paul. Great to be here in Melbourne as well.
Let's get started. You wear many hats. Tell us a little bit about what keeps you busy.
My day job, I'm co-founder and chief policy officer of Global Citizen. We have 12 million members around the world. And then I've recently just become a dad as well. We have a three-month-old child, Mickey. And then I guess in my spare time last year, I also wrote a book as well.
Amazing, amazing. So let's start with fatherhood. Tell me a little bit about, has fatherhood impacted your work?
You know, it's funny. When Mickey was born last year, it occurred to me, you know, we talk about all of these big challenges. We talk about ending extreme poverty by 2030. We talk about addressing climate change, and we talk about the consequences if we don't rise to the occasion. And sometimes those consequences, because we know that some of them are so far into the future, 2100, it occurred to me when she was born, wow, she's going to potentially and hopefully, touch wood, like, still be alive around. She'll be 76, 77. You know, she might have her own grandchildren by then. And I thought, well, she literally will inherit the planet that we leave her. And so for me, I guess it just made the consequences far less abstract when we talk about the tragedy of the horizon. And also just the awareness, it's not actually that far away. And so it really brought home the work we do in a far more personal way, and really thinking about, well, what can I do right now in my work, everything I do and engage with, to make sure that we really address these issues and in a way in which people around the world are going to benefit. But I guess it was also a recognition and understanding. You know, when she was born, we had her in New York, in Manhattan. We were lucky because we had amazing hospital staff, world-class treatment. In New York, we knew that if there was a complication in childbirth or anything happened, we'd receive world-class care. And I guess, you know, she was born just a month or two, you know, what's going on in the world, look at what's going on in the Middle East. And you look at children being on the front lines in many cases of these conflict, they are always the ones who suffer the most. So it was also, I think, a sense of gratitude and understanding of how lucky we were, and how many people around the world, many parents, don't have those same opportunities or access. And so for me, it was also a call to action to recommit to some of the biggest inequities and injustices we see in the world.
So you live in New York, but you travel quite a bit for your role. How was that being a father?
It's funny, before I met my wife, it was traveling all the time. And people think it's glamorous, right? But when you travel and you live in nonprofit land, it's often like you're traveling weird places and you're traveling, staying in as cheap accommodation as you can find. You know, it's often uncomfortable, but you do it because it's part of the mission, right? I think right now, you know, I've traveled a few times since Mickey was born. And really what it does is it teaches you to be disciplined about what really matters. And if you do have to travel, how do you make the most of that? And I think what it's really done is made sure that on my end is a commitment to really make it as impactful as possible and not to waste any time. Last week we were in Brazil And we ended up having an incredible meeting with the First Lady of Brazil, Janja Lula. And we were discussing about food and hunger. But I know that if it's not a good reason, first I'm going to get questions from my wife. But also, we just don't have that long on this planet. So just making sure any available time I've got, I use it in the most impactful way possible.
So you mentioned you've just brought out a book and it's called From Ideas to Impact. So I wanted to start off with, when you say impact, what does that mean?
So I think the way I wrote the book is there's many ways to make a difference in the world, right? As individuals, we can donate to charity. We can encourage people to register to vote. We can have conversations with our friends and family. You know, in America, I always say we talk about climate change a lot, but only 8% of American households actually talk about climate change across a year, right? All of that stuff is important, and I'm not diminishing that at all. But one of the areas which I think receives the least amount of attention is how individuals and everyday citizens can contribute to policy change. And so when I talk about impact, I'm really talking about addressing the big systemic issues our world face and the fact that systemic issues require systemic solutions. It requires policy change, but also really addressing the fact that it's not this abstract issue, policy change. It's about humans, right? It's about the people who they impact. And it's also about the people who implement them. And so really, when I look at it, when I focus on, well, who do I want reading the book? It's everyone. It's people who are members of Rotary clubs. It's university students. It's high school students. And what the book does is it doesn't just outline the case why we should all be involved in efforts to change policy. And we shouldn't just leave it to government alone, because we've tried leaving it to government alone. And if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, they're only 12% achieved right now. We have a huge crisis of implementation, but it also outlines 8 practical steps on how people can begin to change policy, whether that's at a local community level, whether it's at a state level, national level, or even global level.
And in your journey in your life, why has impact become so critical to you?
I guess it's funny, like one of the things I say in the book is to know your why, right? Have a good origin story, because I find when you're meeting with politicians or other decision makers and you go straight in asking them to do something, they're looking at you almost with a hint of suspicion until you tell them why you're there, because they want to know why you're there. You're there just because it's a job. So it's funny you ask me that, because in the book, this is one of the things I say is, know your why and know how to articulate it. I think from my perspective, why I care so much about this sort of impact, you know, I grew up in Perth, Western Australia, most isolated city in the world, but it's also a great place to live, many opportunities. And in my first year of high school, I'll just be completely transparent, I was not great at sport. I was very much not lazy, but like not really motivated to do much. I wasn't great at academics either. I was ranked the lowest kid in the class. My teacher told my mom, Michael's not even going to finish high school, let alone get into university or college. And one day we did this assignment, in-class assignment, and I did it on Roman gladiators and got home from school. My mom said, your teacher rang and said, you somehow topped the class. And they all wondered how I did it. I think they thought I might have cheated or copied someone else. And my teacher the next day said, I think there's more to you than meets the eye. And he challenged me. He said, I think you've got potential here, but you need to work hard. 5 years later, worked hard, managed to top the year group, got in to the 1% of the state, got into law school. Suddenly people were saying, you know, before they're like, oh, you're stupid, lazy, aren't going to amount to anything. Suddenly people were saying, oh, you're so smart. But, you know, in Australia, we have that saying, right? Don't have tickets on yourself. And I always remembered the difference that teacher made in my life. I knew how I felt before he came along and I knew how I felt afterwards. And I just got into university and learned more about the world and the injustices, the inequities. I just occurred to me, like, there's so many children in the planet who probably are far more intelligent, have far more talent and potential than I do, but because they lack access to a great teacher, or maybe they don't have access to school meals at school and that hinders their learning, right? And keeps them from achieving their potential. Whatever reason, whatever barrier they face, that barrier is there and it gets in the way of them achieving their potential. So I guess from my end, that recognition and sense of gratitude for those opportunities is what inspired me to get involved first at university and ultimately in the long saga that saw me giving my life to Global Citizen.
Absolutely. So in the book, you also talk about a divided world. How do you see the division in our world?
One of the examples I use in the book is I talk about actually, you know, and you'd appreciate this, genetically modified food, right? And one of my friends, Professor Glenn Denon, another great Australian who's involved in this movement, he is at Columbia University and he brought out his book last year, Universal Food Security. It's a great book and I recommend it to all your listeners. But one thing I learned about in reading that book was about the saga of golden rice, right? I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, many of your listeners are, but yeah, I wasn't really across it in a big way. But what I read about golden rice is, okay, it's a genetically enriched product, right? But it has the potential to potentially help millions of children who have vitamin deficiencies, right? But there was this huge campaign by many NGOs waged against it, right, over 20 years. And in actual fact, then agricultural scientists, Nobel laureates had to come out and say, guys, let's stop with the stigma here, because let's be honest, most of the food we eat are in some ways genetically modified. We just don't call it that. And this has the potential to save millions of lives. And so I mentioned that actually in the first page of the book, I kid you not, as an example of division, because I call it the purity test. But I think sometimes today, we're very quick to apply the purity test to what are complex issues. And we say, okay, this is a black and white area, when in actual fact, it's shades of gray. And what we do is we say, if engaging in something doesn't ladder up to our vision of how we view the world, right, then we tell ourselves we shouldn't engage, we shouldn't do that. And I think the reason why is right now, in a world that's heavily divided, we're very afraid of offending our tribal loyalties. And the reason why is we're afraid of offending those loyalties because we're afraid of the risks. We're afraid of being called traitors. We're afraid of the risks of outcast. And you see this around the world. Look at the Republican Party in America, right? If someone crosses the line, they face huge political risk. But I also see it in the nonprofit and I see it in the advocacy world too.
No, that's really, really interesting. And I think that the way that you frame that is really helpful for people to kind of understand. So in the book, what are some of the other examples that you see and maybe that you're most excited about? You've talked about golden rice, but what else is there that you think we should be?
So one of the first steps is know your goal, have a good policy goal. And that sounds very obvious, but it occurred to me, you know, often I will get students at a university, Rotarians, other folks reach out to me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and often they want help on how to build a campaign. And when I meet with them and I hear about what they've already got, often what I see is they've got a great problem in mind. It might be ending illegal deforestation. Maybe it's ending hunger in a country. And maybe they even have resources and funding, and they might even have some great, cool campaign branded ideas. But what they actually don't have is a solution. And I'm like, okay, you've got this campaign, but your campaign is all focused on the problem. What solution are you actually putting forward? You can't turn something into impact if you don't have a specific, very concrete understanding of the policies you're trying to change. And so in the book, I walk through how to create and craft, and more importantly, identify a good policy goal. And this is where I actually mentioned SDG2 Advocacy Hub, by the way, because I was inspired by the Beans is How campaign. And I think you spent a lot of time really identifying, well, yes, these issues are very complex, but how do we put forward a bold goal, right? In your case, to double the consumption of beans, right? And the policies, maybe it's like getting schools to prescribe beans in school meals. And so I use that as a concrete example because I loved what you did there. You broke down a complex area, but I also loved the idea that goals. One of my friends, Ari Obinson, who was the former Secretary General of Junior Chamber International, he talks about the fact that if a goal is naively audacious enough, even if you lack experience, even if you lack networks or access to power or funding, he talks about how a naively audacious goal can actually inspire and mobilize people around and help you overcome that implementation experience, give you the networks needed to actually achieve it. But anyway, that's where, yeah, I give you guys a shout out because I think it's a fantastic example.
Well, thank you. And I'm looking forward to getting the book. I've got it on order here and still waiting for it to be delivered. So I think it's still coming out in Australia soon. So out in the US already.
It'll be out in early April. But if you're listening to us in Australia, Boffin's book, you can pre-order it with a 25% discount.
Perfect. So you also talk about Global Citizen. For those who aren't familiar, can you tell us a little bit about what is Global Citizen?
So Global Citizen is a movement of 12 million members around the world. We campaign to end extreme poverty. That's our mission. That's our mandate. All of the actions, campaigns we do come back to that goal. And at Global Citizen, I mean, we're most well known for our big platforms, our big events. You know, right now we're sitting on the eve of Global Citizen Melbourne, right? Where we have literally popular culture and policy. We've got the Minister for International Development, President of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, and then we have Crowded House, right? And of course, in New York, we're most well known for the Global Citizen Festival, which we've been running every year since 2012. But for us, the pop and policy is really important. And so I guess my role as chief policy officer is to make sure that when we're driving popular culture, we're really doing so in a way that galvanizes people to act, gives them a way to take action, and directs them to delivering concrete policy change. And so an example of that, we've for the last few years been supporting the International Fund for Agricultural Development. We've been working with actors like Idris Elba and his incredible wife and UN EFAD ambassador Sabrina Elba, together with the actions of Global Citizens, to get governments to increase their funding for EFAD in order to support millions of people on the front lines of the climate crisis through getting farmers the support and access they need. But since 2012, Global Citizens have taken over 33 million actions. That's helped unlock over $40 billion. And all of this is done in partnership. And that $40 billion has helped to improve the lives of a billion people around the world. And I should just say, Global Citizen sees none of that money. Our job is to hold commitment makers' feet to the fire for the promises they've made and turn talk into action.
So over that period of being involved with Global Citizen, can you tell us what one thing that you wish you knew at the beginning when you started to now? So like looking back, what's one thing that you were like, oh, I wish I knew that?
You know, it's funny, that question is when I started writing the book, that's what I asked myself. What do I wish I knew then that I know now? Look, I think there's many elements here, but one of the goals in the book, I talk about know your end game, right? And policy implementation, it takes time. To do it well, it takes time. And I think too many in our sector, in the advocacy sector, think advocacy is about winning commitments. We think it's about getting a politician to say some nice words, but we tend not to focus on the follow through, right? And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think we're all guilty of that, right? Because it's not sexy. It takes time and it's hard work. And the only way to do that is really to make sure you sustain movements, make sure you grow capacity in nonprofits to hold leaders to account. Because the consequences of that is, you know, you look at France right now. For years, Macron was kind of touting himself as a leader, increasing the aid budget. And then just in recent weeks, we've seen France gut the aid program by billions of dollars. And of course, here in Australia, you know, many people will remember the high watermark of the Make Poverty History moment in Australia. Remember that period, 2006 to 2013, where the aid budget was increasing by, at one point, over $500 million a year. I mean, crazy announced, it was doubling. And then all of a sudden, very quickly, it got cut, right, back to the bone. And it stayed that way for a decade at, you know, record lows. Australia's ranked as one of the least generous nations in the world amongst the wealthy. And a lot of that has to come from the fact that I think we don't ask ourselves the question enough, you know, what can we build today that will last forever? And so in some respects, you come back to Global Citizen, that was an attempt right, to remedy this deficit, because it built an organization around actually holding leaders accountable for their words. And one thing I will say is every commitment announced on a global citizen platform, we track and we monitor the follow through, and then we publish that. But too many of these conferences that's done around the world, you hear all of these nice commitments, politicians clap themselves on the back, they go out for a nice lunch somewhere, and then they forget about it, and the rest of the world doesn't hold their feet to the fire. So I would say knowing your end game is one of the things I wish I understood a lot more, including with respect to some of the campaigns I've worked on where we've seen the pushback.
No, and that's so critical for really driving forward that change, you know, and I think that's really critical. So in 2024, what's your big focus?
So in 2024, we have several focuses. The first of which is really around the fact that we have to address people's basic needs. People talk about the fact 50% of the world, or more than 50% of the planet, is voting this year. You've got the UN hosting the summit of the future, right? About the future of the UN. But the thing is people's trust in these institutions, whether it's democratic institutions, whether it's international institutions, you know, they're in large part going to measure the effectiveness of those institutions based on how well they see it serving their basic needs. And when you've got hunger on the rise, when you've got food aid being weaponized around the world, it's very hard for people to say, well, this is a system working for us. And so I think what I've encouraged our team at Global Citizen is to say, let's get back to a focus on basic needs. That includes access to healthcare. That includes access to food. And it includes addressing the issues focused on it. Then, of course, a big priority for us is also nature and climate. You know, and in particular, you know, what I'm passionate about, I was just in Brazil, but is in supporting the world's indigenous people. They're responsible for over 50% of the world's forests in terms of protecting this natural asset that provides so much benefit. And yet indigenous people make up just 5% of the world's population, and they receive little support. I mean, something like, of all the climate finance and billions of dollars we see around the world, less than 4% goes into supporting those communities, many of them in vulnerable situations, addressing deforestation. And so the final issue that we've been focusing on is really jobs, livelihoods, and increasing access to financing, and making sure that there's economic development and a future for all of the world's people. And this is where I'm excited about the great work of IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, because there's so many opportunities for young people in the agricultural sector, which if we address that, not only will we diversify sources of food around the world at a time when we're seeing increased protectionism, embargoes, you know, obviously with the war in Ukraine, that had a huge impact on access to fertilizer, on access to grain, but it will also provide communities with a way to earn incomes as well, and especially increase the number of jobs available. So we've got jobs and livelihoods, we've got nature and climate, and we've got meeting people's basic needs.
Small change in tact. You're back in Australia. You're living in New York. What's something that you love to eat? And is there anything that you've kind of hit the ground in Australia and gone looking for?
Okay, so I'll answer the question first. I was going to say, I wonder if Australia has it, but I love hummus. So hummus is one of my favorite things. I can have hummus on everything. I can have hummus on pizza, on pasta. I can put hummus in a burger. I can have hummus by itself. I'm happy to just eat it with a spoon. My favorite is to have it with raw broccoli. I love the crunch of broccoli with hummus. There's nothing better in the world. And of course, I've learned to make my own hummus with a great recipe that a friend gave to me. The trick I've learned is to go hard on the tahini, the chickpeas, and also with the za'atar, the spices, and to only use a dash of lemon. Because what I found is many of the packets of hummus you might buy in a store in New York, they over-index, I guess because it's a preservative, but they over-index on the lemon, and that's where you get that more soury taste. So I go less on the lemon. But yeah, I was going to say, I'm sure Australia has some great hummus. This was a recipe I really perfected, I mean, in my humble opinion, during the pandemic. So yeah, I'll have to check it out while I'm here.
If I'm not wrong, I think Australia is one of the largest exporters of chickpeas around the
world.
Is
that right? So I actually didn't know that.
I definitely know when I was in India, they're the largest exporter to India of chickpeas.
Is that right? Wow.
And that fits into our Beans is How family. So you're right on there.
Okay,
so
cool.
Beans, so peas and lentils.
I'm helping propagate the Beans is How campaign. There you go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
You've been listening to Future Fork, a show that explores the world of food and the decisions we can make today that will shape our future. Future Fork is produced by Disruptive Consulting Solutions and supports the SDG2 Advocacy Hub. For more info, head to the website futureforkpodcast.com. This show was produced with strategy and production support from Wavelength Creative. So you don't miss an episode of Future Fork, make sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Paul Newnham, and I'll see you in the next episode.